Vronsky and Koznishev, all were there.
"Why are you so late?"
asked the old prince with a smile, holding out his hand over his shoulder.
"How's Kitty?"
he added, smoothing the table napkin, which he had tucked in behind a button of his waistcoat.
"She's all right. They're all three dining together."
"Ah, Arline's Nardine's. Well, there's no room at our table. Go to that table and be quick and secure a seat," said the old prince.
And turning away, he carefully took a plate of fish soup that was handed to him.
"Levin! Here!"
shouted someone a little farther off in a kindly voice. It was Turovtsin. He sat beside a young military man, and two chairs were tilted against their table. Levin joined them with pleasure. He always liked that good-natured spendthrift Turovtsin. With him was associated the memory of his proposal to Kitty. But today, after all those strained intellectual conversations, Turovtsin's good-natured face was particularly welcome.
"These are for you and Oblonsky. He will be here in a minute."
The military man, with merry, ever-laughing eyes, who held himself very erect, was Gagin from Petersburg. Turovtsin introduced him.
"Oblonsky is always late."
"Ah, here he is."
"Have you just come?"
asked Oblonsky, hastening toward them.
"How do you do?
Had any vodka? Well then, come."
Levin rose and went with him to a large table on which stood various kinds of vodka and a very varied assortment of hors d'oeuvre. It might have been thought that from a score of different hors d'oeuvre it would be possible to select one to any taste, but Oblonsky ordered something special, and one of the liveried footmen brought it at once. They drank a glass of vodka each and returned to their table. While they were still at their soup, Gagin ordered a bottle of champagne and had four glasses filled. Levin did not refuse the proffered wine and ordered another bottle. He was hungry and ate and drank with great pleasure, and with still greater pleasure took part in the simple, merry talk of his companions. Gagin, lowering his voice, related a new Petersburg anecdote which, though it was indecent and stupid, was so funny that Levin burst into loud laughter and people turned to look at him.
"That's in the style of the story. That's just what I can't bear. Do you know it?" asked Oblonsky. "Oh, it's delightful. Bring another bottle," he called to the waiter, and immediately began telling the story.
"With Pyotr Ilyich Vinovsky's compliments," interrupted an old waiter, bringing two delicate glasses of still sparkling champagne on a tray and addressing Oblonsky and Levin.
Oblonsky took a glass, and exchanging a look with a bald, red-haired man with a moustache who sat at the other end of their table, smilingly nodded to him.
"Who is that?" inquired Levin. "You once met him at my house, do you remember? A nice fellow."
Levin followed Oblonsky's example and took the glass. Oblonsky's anecdote was very amusing, too. Then Levin told one, which also was appreciated. Then they talked about horses, about that day's races, and how gallantly Vronsky's Atlas Nyi had won the first prize. Levin hardly noticed how the dinner passed.
"Ah, here they are,"
said Oblonsky, just as they were finishing, leaning back in his chair and stretching out his hand to Vronsky, who was approaching with a tall colonel of the guards. Vronsky's face, too, was lit up by the general pleasant good humour of the club. Gaily leaning his arm on Oblonsky's shoulder, he whispered something to him, and with the same merry smile held out a hand to Levin.
"Very glad to meet you," he said. "I looked for you that day at the elections, but was told you had already left."
"Yes, I left that same day. We were just speaking about your horse."
"I congratulate you," said Levin. "That was quick running."
"Oh, yes.
You keep racehorses, too?"
"No. My father did, and I remember them and know something about them."
"Where did you dine?"
asked Oblonsky.
"At the second table, behind the pillars."
"He has been congratulated," remarked the colonel. "It's the second time he's won the Imperial Prize. If only I had the luck at cards that he has with horses. But why waste the golden moments? I'm off
to the infernal regions," added he, and walked away.
"That's Yashvin," said Vronsky in reply to Turovtsin's question as he took a vacant chair beside them. He drank a glass of champagne they offered him, and ordered another bottle. Whether influenced by the club or by the wine he had drunk, Lievin chatted with Vronsky about the best breeds of cattle, and was very pleased to find that he had not the least animosity toward the man. He even told Vronsky, among other things, that he had heard from his wife that she had met him at the Princess Maria Borisovna's.
"Oh, the Princess Maria Borisovna! Isn't she charming?" cried Oblonsky,
and related an anecdote about her which made them all laugh. Vronsky especially burst into such good-natured laughter that Lievin felt quite reconciled to him.
"Well, have you finished?"
asked Oblonsky, rising and smiling.
"Let's go."
Chapter 8. On leaving the table, Lievin, feeling that as he went his arms swung with unusual regularity and ease, passed with Gagin through the lofty apartments to the billiard room. When they had traversed the large hall, he met his father-in-law.
"Well, and how do you like our Temple of Idleness?" said the prince, giving him his arm. "Come, let's walk about a little."
"Yes, a walk is just what I want, and to have a look round. It interests me."
"Yes, it interests you, but my interest is different to yours." "You look at those old men," said the prince, indicating a round-shouldered member with a hanging nether lip, hardly able to shuffle along in his soft boots, who met and passed them. "And you imagine they were born schlupiks?"
"Schlupiks? What's that?"
"You see, you don't even know the word. It is a club term. You know the game of egg rolling? Well, an egg that has been rolled very often becomes a schlupik. And so it is with ourselves. We keep coming and coming to the club until we turn into schlupiks."
"Now you're laughing. But we are already thinking of how we shall become schlupiks."
"You know Prince Chechensky?" asked the prince,
and Lievin saw by his face that he was going to say something droll.
"No, I don't." "You don't? What, the well-known Prince Chechensky? Well, never mind. He is always playing billiards, you know. 3 years ago he was not yet among the schlupiks, and he showed a bold front, calling others schlupiks. Well, one day he arrives, and our hall porter, you know Vasily, oh yes, that fat one, he's a great wit. Well, Prince Chechensky asks him, 'I say, Vasily, who is here, any of the schlupiks?' And Vasily replies, 'Well, yes, you're the third one.'"
"Yes, my lad, that's how it is."
Chatting and exchanging greetings with acquaintances they chanced to meet, Lievin and the prince passed through all the rooms. The large one, in which card tables were already arranged and habitual partners were playing for small stakes, the sofa room where they were playing chess and where Koznishev sat talking to someone, the billiard room where, by a sofa in a recess, a merry party, which included Gagin, were drinking champagne. They looked in at the infernal regions, too, where round a table, at which Yashvin had already taken his seat, crowded a number of backers. Taking care not to make a noise, they entered the dim reading room, where, under shaded lamps, a young man with an angry countenance sat turning over one newspaper after another, and a bald general was engrossed in what he was reading. They also went into the room which the prince termed the wise room. There, three gentlemen were arguing about the latest political news.
"Will you come, Prince? Everything is ready,"
said one of his habitual partners, finding him there, and the prince went away. Lievin sat down for a while and listened, but remembering all the conversations he had that day heard, he suddenly felt terribly bored. He rose hastily and went to look for Oblonsky and Turovtsin, with whom he had felt merry. Turovtsin, with a tankard of something to drink, was sitting on the high sofa in the billiard room, and Oblonsky was talking to Vronsky by the door in the far corner.
"She is not exactly dull, but that indefinite, unsettled position," Lievin overheard,
and was hastening away when Oblonsky called him.
"Lievin," said he,
and Lievin noticed that though in Oblonsky's eyes there were not actually tears, they were moist, as they always were when he had been drinking or when he felt touched. Today it was both.
"Lievin, don't go,"
he said, holding him tightly by the elbow, evidently not wishing to let him go on any account.
"This is my true, almost my best friend," he said to Vronsky. "You two are even more near and dear to me, and I want you to be friends. And I know that you will be friendly and intimate, because you are both good fellows."
"Well, then, there's nothing for it but to kiss and be friends," said Vronsky, good-naturedly jesting and holding out his hand. He quickly grasped Levin's outstretched hand and pressed it.
"I am very, very glad," said Levin, pressing Vronsky's hand. "Waiter, bring a bottle of champagne," said Oblonsky.
"And I am glad, too," said Vronsky. But in spite of Oblonsky's wish and theirs, they had nothing to say to one another, and both knew it.
"You know, he's not acquainted with Anna," said Oblonsky to Vronsky.
"And I particularly wish to take him to see her.
Let's go, Levin."
"Really," said Vronsky, "she will be very glad.
I would go home at once, but I am anxious about Yashvin and want to stay here till he has finished."
"Oh, is he in a bad way?"
"He keeps on losing, and I alone can restrain him."
"Then what do you say to pyramids? Levin, will you play?"
"Oh, capital," said Oblonsky.
"Place the balls for pyramids," he added, turning to the billiard marker.
"They have been ready a long time," replied the marker, who had already placed the balls in a triangle and was rolling the red ball about to pass the time.
"Well, come along."
After the game, Vronsky and Levin joined Gagin at his table, and at Oblonsky's invitation, Levin began betting on aces. Vronsky sat beside the table, surrounded by friends who were continually coming to him, or else went to the infernal regions to see what Yashvin was up to. Levin experienced an agreeable sense of relief from the mental weariness of the morning. He was glad the hostility between Vronsky and himself was ended, and the impression of tranquillity, decorum, and pleasure did not leave him. When they had finished their play, Oblonsky took Levin's arm.
"Well, then, let us go to Anna's. Now, at once. She will be at home. I promised her long ago to bring you. Where were you going tonight?"
"Nowhere in particular. I had promised Sviatsky to go to the Agricultural Society's meeting, but I'll come with you if you like," replied Levin.
"Capital! Let's go! Find out whether my carriage has come," said Oblonsky to a footman.
Levin went to the table, paid the 40 rubles he had lost betting on the aces, paid the club bill to an old footman who stood by the door, and who seemed in some miraculous way to know what it came to, and, swinging his arms in a peculiar way, passed through the whole suite of rooms to the exit. Chapter 9.
"The Oblonsky carriage!"
shouted the hall porter in a stern bass. The carriage drove up and they got in. Only for the first few moments, while they were leaving the courtyard of the club, did Levin retain that sense of club calm, pleasure, and undoubted decorum in his surroundings. But as soon as the carriage had passed out into the street and he felt it jolting on the uneven road, heard the angry shouts of an izvozchik they met, saw in the ill-lit street the red signboards of a vodka dealer and of a small shop, that sense was dissipated, and he began to consider his actions and to ask himself whether he was doing right in going to see Anna. What would Kitty say? But Oblonsky would not let him reflect, and as if guessing his doubts, tried to dispel them.
"How glad I am that you will make her acquaintance," said he. "Do you know, Dolly has long wished it, and Lyovov called on her and goes to see her." "Though she is my sister," Oblonsky continued, "I may safely say that she is a remarkable woman. Well, you'll see. Her position is a very trying one, especially just now."
"Why especially just now?"
"We are negotiating with her husband about a divorce. He agrees, but there are difficulties about her son, and the affair, which should have been ended long ago, has already been dragging on for 3 months. As soon as she gets the divorce, she will marry Vronsky. How stupid that old ceremony is.
walking round and round singing Rejoice, Isaiah, a ceremony in which nobody believes and which stands in the way of people's happiness, interpolated Oblonsky. Well, and then their position will be as definite as mine or yours.
What is the difficulty? Asked Levin.
Oh, that is a long and tiresome story. Everything is so indefinite in this country. But the point is that she has been living for several weeks in Moscow, where everybody knows her and him, awaiting the divorce, without going out anywhere or seeing any women except Dolly, because, you understand, she does not want people to come and see her as a charity. Even that fool Princess Barbara has left her, considering it improper. Well, you see, any woman in her position might fail to find resources in herself, but she... You'll see how she has arranged her life, how quiet and dignified she is.
To the left, in the side street, opposite the church, shouted Oblonsky, leaning out of the carriage window. Oh, how hot, he said, throwing his already unfastened overcoat still wider open, in spite of 12 degrees of frost.
But she has a child. I suppose she is occupied with her, said Levin.
I think you see in every woman only a female, une couveuse, necessarily occupied with children, if at all, said Oblonsky.
No, I believe Anna is bringing her up splendidly, but one does not hear about her. Her occupations are, firstly, writing.
I can see you smiling sarcastically, but you are wrong. She is writing a children's book and does not speak of it to anyone, but she read it to me, and I showed the manuscript to Vorkuyev, you know, the publisher. He writes himself, I think. He is an expert and says it is a remarkable work.
But do you think she is a woman author?
Not at all. She is, first of all, a woman with a heart.
You'll see.
She now has a little English girl and a whole family she is interested in.
Why, is it a philanthropic undertaking?
There you are, at once looking out for something bad.
It's not philanthropy, it's kind-heartedness.
They had, I mean, Vronsky had, an English trainer, a master in his own line, but a drunkard. He took completely to drink, got delirium tremens, and has deserted his family. She saw them, helped them, and became interested in them, and now the whole family is on her hands. And she doesn't do it patronizingly, just with money. But she herself coaches the boys in Russian for the high school, and she has taken the girl into the house. But you'll see her.
The carriage drove into the courtyard, and Oblonsky rang loudly at the front door, before which a sledge was standing. Without asking the porter who opened the door whether Anna was in, Oblonsky entered the hall. Levin followed, more and more in doubt as to whether he was acting well or badly. Glancing in the mirror, Levin saw that he was red in the face, but he was sure he was not tipsy, and he followed Oblonsky up the carpeted stairs. On the top landing, a footman bowed to Oblonsky as to someone he knew well, and Oblonsky, asking who was with Anna Arkadyevna, received the answer that it was Mr. Vorkuyev.
Where are they?
In the study. Passing through a small dining room panelled in dark wood, Oblonsky and Levin entered the study across the soft carpet. It was lit by a lamp with a large, dark shade. Another reflector lamp fixed to the wall illuminated a large, full-length portrait of a woman, which attracted Levin's involuntary attention. It was Anna's portrait, painted in Italy by Mikhailov. While Oblonsky passed behind a screen of trellis work, and the man's voice that had been speaking became silent, Levin looked at the portrait, which, in the bright illumination, seemed to step out of its frame, and he could not tear himself away from it. He forgot where he was, and without listening to what was being said, gazed fixedly at the wonderful portrait. It was not a picture, but a living and charming woman with curly black hair, bare shoulders and arms, and a dreamy half-smile on lips covered with elegant down, looking at him victoriously and tenderly with eyes that troubled him. The only thing that showed she was not alive was that she was more beautiful than a living woman could be. "I am so glad," he heard a voice saying nearby, evidently addressing him,
the voice of the very woman whom he had admired in the portrait. Anna had come out from behind the screen to meet him, and Lievin saw in the dim light of the study the woman of the portrait, in a dark dress of different shades of blue, not in the same attitude, not with the same expression, but on the same height of beauty as that on which the artist had caught her in the portrait. In reality, she was less brilliant, but there was something about her new and attractive which was not in the portrait. Chapter 10. She had risen to greet him, not concealing her pleasure at seeing him. The tranquillity with which she extended to him her energetic little hand introduced him to Vorkuyev, and indicating a pretty red-haired child who sat in the same room doing needlework, spoke of her as her ward, showed the manners, familiar and pleasant to Lievin, of a woman of good society, always self-possessed and natural. "I am very, very pleased," she repeated, and from her lips these simple words seemed to Lievin to possess a peculiar meaning. "I have known and liked you both for your friendship to Stiva and for your wife's sake. I only knew her for a very short time, but she left on me the impression of a lovely flower. Just a flower. And she will soon be a mother?" She spoke easily and without haste, occasionally turning her eyes from Lievin to her brother. Lievin felt that the impression he was creating was a good one, and immediately became at ease and as natural and comfortable with her as if he had known her from childhood. "We came into Alexei's room to have a smoke," she said, in reply to Oblonsky's question whether he might smoke. And glancing at Lievin, instead of asking him whether he smoked, she drew a tortoiseshell cigar case nearer and took from it a straw cigarette. "How are you today?" asked her brother.
"Pretty well.
Nerves, as usual."
"Isn't it wonderfully good?"
said Oblonsky, noticing that Lievin kept looking at the portrait. "I have never seen a better portrait." "And it's a wonderful likeness, isn't it?" asked Vorkuyev. Lievin glanced from the portrait to the original. A special brightness lit up Anna's face when she felt his eyes on her. Lievin flushed, and to hide his confusion was about to ask her if it was long since she had seen Dolly. But at that instant Anna herself began to speak.
"We were just talking with Ivan Pyotrovich about Vashchenko's last pictures. Have you seen them?"
"Yes, I have," replied Lievin.
"But excuse me, I interrupted you. You were going to say..."
Lievin asked whether she had seen Dolly lately.
"She was here yesterday. She is very angry with the high school because of Grisha. The Latin master, it seems, has been unjust to him."
"Yes, I have seen the pictures, and did not like them very much," Lievin said, returning to the subject she had started. Lievin did not now speak at all in the matter-of-fact way in which he had talked that morning. Every word of his conversation with her assumed a special importance. It was pleasant to speak to her, and yet more pleasant to listen to her. Anna not only talked naturally and cleverly, but cleverly and carelessly, not attributing any value to her own ideas, but attributing great value to those of her interlocutor. The conversation touched on the new direction taken by art and the new illustrations of the Bible by a French artist. Vorkuyev accused the artist of realism pushed to coarseness. Lievin said the French had carried conventionality in art further than anyone else, and therefore attributed special merit to a return to realism. In the fact that they had left off lying, they perceived poetry. Never had any clever thought uttered by Lievin given him so much satisfaction as this. Anna's face brightened all over when she suddenly appreciated the remark. She laughed. "I am laughing as one laughs on seeing a very striking likeness. What you have said quite characterizes present-day French art, painting, and even literature. Zola, Daudet. But perhaps it is always like that. They form their conceptions from imaginary, conventional figures, and when they have made every possible combination of these, they tire of the conventional figures and begin to devise more natural and correct ones."
"Yes, that's it. Exactly," said Vorkuyev.
"So you have been to the club?" she said, addressing her brother.
"What a woman!" thought Levin.
And quite forgetting himself, he gazed fixedly at her beautiful, mobile face, which had now suddenly quite changed. Levin did not hear what she was speaking about while she leant toward her brother, but was struck by the change in her expression. After being so lovely in its tranquillity, her face suddenly expressed a strange curiosity, anger, and pride. But this lasted only a moment. She screwed up her eyes, as if she were remembering something. "However, that won't interest anyone," she said. And turning to the little English girl, she added in English, "Please order tea in the drawing room." The child rose and went out.
"Well, has she passed her examination?" inquired Oblonsky.
"Splendidly. She is a very capable girl and has a sweet nature."
"You'll finish by being fonder of her than of your own."
"How like a man! There is no more or less in love. I love my child with one kind of love and her with another."
"I was just saying to Anna Arkadyevna," remarked Vorkuyev, "that if she were to devote to the general business of educating Russian children 1/100th part of the energy she bestows on this English child, she would be doing a great and useful work."
"Yes, but say what you like, I can't do it. Count Alexei urged me very much."
As she spoke the words "Count Alexei," she turned a timidly petitioning glance toward Levin, and he involuntarily replied with a respectful and confirmatory glance.
"He urged me to take an interest in the village school. I went several times. They are very nice children. But I could not attach myself to the work. You mention energy. Energy is based on love. And where is one to get the love? One can't order it. I've become fond of this girl, you see, without knowing why."
Again she glanced at Levin, and her smile and glance told him that she was speaking for him alone, valuing his opinion, and knowing in advance that they would understand one another.
"Yes, I quite understand," Levin replied. "It is impossible to put one's heart into a school or an institution of that kind, and I think that is just why philanthropic establishments always give such poor results."
After a pause, she smiled and said, "Yes, yes, I never could do it. Je n'ai pas le cœur assez large to love a whole orphanage full of unpleasant little girls. Cela ne m'a jamais réussi. There are so many women who have created for themselves a social position in that way. And now, especially," she went on with a sad, confiding expression, as though addressing her brother but evidently speaking to Levin, "now, when I so need some occupation, I can't do it." And with a sudden frown, Levin understood that she was frowning at herself for having spoken about herself, she changed the subject. "I have heard it said of you," said she to Levin, "that you are a bad citizen, and I have defended you as best I could."
"How did you defend me?"
"Well, that varied with the attacks.
However, won't you come and have some tea?"
She rose and took up a book bound in Morocco leather.
"Let me have it, Anna Arkadyevna," said Vorkuyev, pointing to the book. "It is well worth it."
"Oh, no, it is so unfinished."
"I have told him about it,"
remarked Oblonsky to his sister, indicating Levin.
"You should not have done so.
My writings are something like those little baskets and carvings made in prisons which Lisa Merkalova used to sell to me. She used to preside over the prison department of a society," she added, turning to Levin, "and those unfortunate people achieved miracles of patience." And Levin perceived yet another feature in this woman whom he already liked so much. In addition to her intelligence, grace, and beauty, she also possessed sincerity. She did not wish to hide from him the hardships of her position. When she had finished speaking, she sighed, and all at once her face assumed a stern expression and became rigid. With that expression, her face seemed even more beautiful than before. But it was a novel look. It was outside the circle of expressions radiating happiness and creating happiness
which the artist had caught when painting her portrait. Lievin again looked at the portrait and at her figure as, arm in arm with her brother, she passed through the lofty doorway, and he felt a tenderness and pity for her which surprised him. She asked Lievin and Vorkuyev to pass on into the drawing-room, and herself remained behind to speak to her brother. About the divorce? About Vronsky? About what he was doing at the club? About me? Lievin wondered. And he was so excited about what she might be saying to Oblonsky that he hardly listened to what Vorkuyev was telling him about the merits of Anna's story for children. Over their tea, they continued the same kind of pleasant and interesting talk. There was not a single moment when it was necessary to seek for a subject of conversation. On the contrary, one felt that there was not time enough to say what one wanted to say, but willingly refrained in order to hear what she was saying. It seemed to Lievin that all that was said, not only by her, but also by Vorkuyev and Oblonsky, assumed a special importance owing to her attention and remarks. While following this interesting conversation, Lievin all the time continued to admire her. Her beauty, her cleverness, her good education, together with her simplicity and sincerity. He listened and talked, and all the time thought of her inner life, trying to guess her feelings. And he, who had formerly judged her so severely, now by some strange process of reasoning justified her and at the same time pitied her and feared that Vronsky did not fully understand her. Toward 11, when Oblonsky rose to leave, Vorkuyev had already gone, Lievin felt as if he had only just arrived. He got up, regretfully. "Goodbye," she said, retaining his hand, and gazing at him with a look that drew him to her. "I am very pleased que la glace est rompue." She let go his hand and screwed up her eyes. "Tell your wife that I am just as fond of her as ever, and that if she cannot forgive me my situation, I wish her never to forgive me." To forgive, she would have to live through what I have lived through. And may God preserve her from that.
"Certainly. Yes. I will tell her," said Lievin, blushing.
Chapter 11.
"What a wonderful, sweet, pathetic woman," he thought as he and Oblonsky went out into the frosty air.
"Well, didn't I tell you?" said Oblonsky, who saw that Lievin had been entirely vanquished.
"Yes," responded Lievin pensively.
"An extraordinary woman.
Not on account of her intellect, but
her wonderful sincerity.
I'm dreadfully sorry for her."
"Oh, God willing, everything will now soon be settled."
"Well, another time, don't judge in advance," said Oblonsky, opening the door of his carriage.
"Goodbye. We're not going the same way."
Without ceasing to think of Anna, and of all the words, simple in the extreme, which they had interchanged, recalling every detail of the expressions of her face, entering more and more into her situation, and feeling more and more sorry for her, Lievin reached home. At home he heard from Kuzma that Kitty was well, and that her sisters had not long been gone, and he was given two letters. These he read in the anteroom so as not to let them divert his attention later on. One was from his steward, Sokolov, who wrote that the wheat could not be sold, because only 5.5 rubles a chetvert was bid, and added that there was no other source from which to get money. The other letter was from his sister, who reproached him for not having settled her business yet.
"Well, we'll sell it at 5.5 if they won't give more." Lievin promptly settled the first matter with great ease, though it had previously appeared to him so difficult.
"It's surprising how all one's time gets taken up here," he thought, with reference to the second letter.
He felt himself to blame because he had not yet done what his sister asked of him.
"Today again I did not go to the court, but today I really had no time."
and resolving that he would attend to it next day without fail, he went to his wife. On his way, he ran over in his mind the whole of the past day. All the events had consisted of conversations, conversations to which he had listened or in which he had taken part. All these conversations were about matters he would never have occupied himself with had he been in the country, but here they were very interesting. All of them had been good, and only two things were not quite pleasant. One was what he had said about the pike, and the other was that there was something not quite right about his tender pity for Anna. Levin found his wife sad and depressed. The three sisters' dinner party would have gone off very well, except that he did not come in as they expected, and they all became dull. Then the sisters left, and she remained alone. "Well, and what have you been doing?" she asked, looking him in the eyes, which had a suspicious glitter in them. But, not to hinder his relating everything, she masked her observation and listened with an appreciative smile while he told her how he had spent the evening. "I was very pleased to meet Vronsky. I felt quite at ease and quite natural with him. You see, I shall now try to avoid meeting him again, but the constraint will no longer exist," said he, and remembering that, whilst trying to avoid meeting him again, he had gone straight to Anna's, he blushed. "There now, we say the people drink, but I don't know who drinks most, the common people or our own class. The common people drink on holidays, but..." But Kitty was not interested in the question of how the people drink. She had seen his blush and wanted to know the reason.
"Well, and where did you go then?"
"Stiva particularly begged me to call on Anna Arkadyevna." On saying this, Levin blushed still more, and his doubts as to whether he had done right or wrong in going to see Anna were finally solved. He now knew that he should not have gone there. Kitty's eyes opened in a peculiar manner and flashed at the mention of Anna's name, but making an effort she hid her agitation and so deceived him.
"Ah," was all she said.
"I'm sure you won't be angry with me for going. Stiva asked me to, and Dolly wished it," continued Levin.
"Oh no," she said.
But he saw by her eyes the effort she made to control herself, and it boded him no good. "She's very charming, very, very much to be pitied, and a good woman," he said, telling her about Anna and her occupations and the message she had sent.
"Yes, of course she is much to be pitied," said Kitty when he had finished.
"From whom were your letters?" He told her, and misled by her quiet manner, went to undress. When he returned, he found Kitty still sitting in the chair where he had left her. When he drew near, she looked at him and burst into sobs.
"What is it? What is it?" he asked, well aware what it was.
"You have fallen in love with that horrid woman. She has bewitched you. I saw it in your eyes. Yes, yes. Oh, what can come of it? You were at the club, drinking and drinking, gambling, and then you went... to whom? Oh, no. Let's go away. I will leave tomorrow."
It was long before Levin could pacify his wife. At last he managed it, but only by acknowledging that a sense of pity after the wine he had drunk had misled him, that he had yielded to Anna's artful influence, and he would avoid her in future. One thing that he sincerely confessed was that, living so long in Moscow with nothing but talk and food and drink, he was going silly. They talked till 3 in the morning, and only then were they sufficiently reconciled to fall asleep. Chapter 12. When her visitors had taken their leave, Anna did not sit down, but began pacing up and down the room. Though she had involuntarily done all in her power to awaken love in Lievin, as at that time she always did to all the young men she met, and though she knew she had succeeded in as far as was possible with an honourable married man in one evening, and though she had liked him very much, despite the marked difference between Vronsky and Lievin from a man's point of view, she, as a woman, saw in them that common trait which had caused Kitty to fall in love with them both. Yet as soon as he had left the room, she ceased to think about him. One thought, and only one, pursued her remorselessly in different forms. If I produce such an effect on others, on this married man who loves his wife, why is he so cold toward me? And it's not coldness, for I know he loves me, but something fresh now divides us. Why has he been away all the evening? He sent word by Steva that he could not leave Yashvin, but must keep an eye on his play. Is Yashvin such a child? But admitting that it's true, he never tells lies. Then behind that truth there is something else. He is glad of a chance to show me that he has other obligations. I know he has, I agree to that. But why prove it to me? He wishes to give me proofs that his love of me must not interfere with his freedom, but I don't need proofs. I need love. He ought to understand the hardship of my life here in Moscow. Is it life? I do not live, but only wait for a solution which is deferred and still deferred. Again, no answer. And Steva says he can't go to see Alexei Alexandrovich, and I can't write again. I can't do anything, begin anything, change anything. I restrain myself, wait, invent occupations for myself. The English family, writing, reading, but all that is only deception. It is all a kind of morphia.
He ought to pity me,
said she, feeling tears of self-compassion rising to her eyes. She heard Vronsky's vehement ring at the front door and quickly dried her eyes. She even sat down near the lamp and opened a book, pretending to be tranquil. She must let him see that she was displeased that he had not returned when he had promised. Displeased. That should be all. She would on no account show him her grief, and still less her self-compassion. She might pity herself, but he must not pity her. She did not want strife, and blamed him for wanting to fight, but yet she involuntarily took up a fighting attitude.
"Well, you've not been dull," he asked cheerfully and with animation, coming up to her. "What a terrible passion gambling is!"
"No, I have not been dull. I have long ago learnt not to feel dull. Steva and Lievin were here."
"Yes, I knew they were coming to see you. And how did you like Lievin?" he asked, taking a seat beside her.
"Very much. They only left a short while ago."
"What did Yashvin do?"
"He was lucky and won 17,000. I called him away and very nearly got him to come, but he went back and now has lost more than he had won."
"Then what was the good of your staying with him?" she said, suddenly raising her eyes to his face. Her look was cold and hostile. "You told Steva you were staying to bring Yashvin away, but you have left him." A similar cold expression of readiness for strife appeared on his face.
"For one thing, I did not give him any message for you. And for another, I never say what is not true. But chiefly, I wanted to stay. So I stayed," he replied with a frown.
"Anna."
"Why? Why?"
he asked after a short pause, bending toward her and opening his hand, hoping that she would place hers in it. She was pleased by this appeal to tenderness. But some strange evil power prevented her from yielding to her impulse, as if the conditions of the struggle did not allow her to submit.
Of course you wished to stay and stayed. You always do what you wish. But why tell me? Why? She said, becoming more and more agitated. Does anyone dispute your right? But you want to be in the right, so in the right you must be.
His hand closed. He leant back, and his face assumed a still more stubborn look.
For you, it's a matter of obstinacy, she said, after gazing intently at him, and suddenly finding a name for that look that irritated her so. Just obstinacy. For you, it is a question whether you will conquer me, and for me...
Again she felt sorry for herself and nearly burst into tears.
If you only knew what it means to me. When I feel as I do now, that you are hostile toward me, hostile is the right word. If you only knew what that means to me. If you knew how near I am to a catastrophe at such moments, how afraid I am. Afraid of myself.
And she turned away to hide her sobs.
But what is it all about? He said, horrified at her expression of despair,
and again leaning toward her, he took her hand and kissed it.
What have I done? Do I seek amusement outside our home? Do I not avoid the society of women?
I should hope so, she said. Well then, tell me what I should do to make you easy.
I am ready to do anything to make you happy, he went on, touched by her despair. What would I not do to spare you such grief as this about I know not what?
Anna, nothing, nothing, she replied.
I don't know myself whether it is this lonely life or nerves. But don't let's talk about it.
What about the races? You haven't told me about them. And she tried to hide her triumph at her victory. For the victory was hers, after all. He asked for supper and began telling her about the races. But by his tone and by his looks, which grew colder and colder, she saw that he had not forgiven her her victory, and that the obstinacy against which she had fought had again taken possession of him. He was colder to her than before, as if he repented of having submitted. And remembering the words which had given her the victory, I am near a catastrophe and afraid of myself. She realized that they were a dangerous weapon and must not be used a second time. She felt that side by side with the love that united them, there had grown up some evil spirit of strife, which she could not cast out of his heart, and still less out of her own.
Chapter 13. There are no conditions of life to which a man cannot accustom himself, especially if he sees that everyone around him lives in the same way. 3 months previously, Levin would not have believed that he could quietly fall asleep under the circumstances in which he now found himself, that while leading an aimless, senseless life, one moreover that was above his means, after tippling, he could call what had happened in the club by no other name, after showing unsuitable friendship to the man with whom his wife had once been in love, and after a still more unsuitable visit to a woman who could only be called a fallen woman, and after being allured by her and having grieved his wife, that in such circumstances he could quietly fall asleep. But under the influence of weariness, a sleepless night, and the wine he had drunk, he slept soundly and peacefully. At 5 in the morning, the creak of an opening door woke him. He jumped up and looked round. Kitty was not in the bed beside him, but on the other side of the partition a light was moving, and he heard her step.
What is it? What is it?
He muttered, not yet quite awake. Kitty, what is it?
Nothing, said she, coming candle in hand from beyond the partition. I only felt a little unwell,
she added with a peculiarly sweet and significant smile.
What? Has it begun? Has it?
He asked in a frightened voice.
We must send...
And he began to dress hurriedly.
No, no, she said, smiling, holding him back with her hand. I'm sure it's nothing. I only felt slightly unwell. But it is over now.
She came back to her bed, put out the candle, lay down, and remained quiet. Though that quietness, as if she were holding her breath, and especially the peculiar tenderness and animation with which, returning from the other side of the partition, she had said, "It's nothing," seemed to him suspicious, yet he was so sleepy that he fell asleep at once. Only afterwards he remembered that bated breath and realized all that had passed in her dear, sweet soul while she lay motionless by his side, awaiting the greatest event of a woman's life. At 7 o'clock he was awakened by her touch on his shoulder and a soft whisper. She seemed to hesitate between regret at waking him and a desire to speak to him.
Kostya, don't be frightened. It's nothing, but I think we must send for Maria Vlasyevna.
The candle was burning again. She was sitting on the bed, holding in her hands some knitting she had lately been doing.
Please don't be frightened. It's nothing. I'm not a bit afraid,
she said on seeing his alarmed face, and she pressed his hand to her breast and then to her lips. He jumped up hastily, hardly aware of himself, and without taking his eyes off her, put on his dressing gown and stood still, gazing at her. It was necessary for him to go, but he could not tear himself away from the sight of her. He had loved that face and known all its expressions and looks, but he had never seen her as she was now.
How vile and despicable he appeared to himself before her she now was when he recollected the grief he had caused her yesterday.
Her flushed face, surrounded with soft hair that had escaped from beneath her nightcap, shone with joy and resolution. Little as there was of affectation and conventionality in Kitty's general character, yet Levin was astonished at what was revealed to him now that every veil had fallen and the very kernel of her soul shone through her eyes. And in this simplicity, this nakedness of soul, she whom he loved was more apparent than ever. She looked at him smilingly, but suddenly her eyebrows twitched. She raised her head, and coming quickly to him, she took hold of his hand, and clinging close, she enveloped him in her hot breath. She was suffering, and seemed to be complaining to him of her pain, and for a moment, from force of habit, he felt as if he were in fault. But her look expressed a tenderness which told him that she not only did not blame him, but loved him because of those sufferings.
I am not to blame for it. Who is?
He thought, involuntarily seeking a culprit to punish for these sufferings. But there was no culprit. She suffered, complained, triumphed in her sufferings, rejoiced in them, and loved them. He saw that something beautiful was taking place in her soul, but what it was he could not understand.
It was above his comprehension. I have sent for Mama, and you, go quickly and fetch Maria Vlasyevna. Kostya! No, it's nothing. It's past.
She moved away from him and rang.
Well, go now. Pasha is coming. I'm all right.
And Levin saw with amazement that she again took up the knitting which she had fetched in the night and recommenced work. As Levin went out at one door, he heard the maid enter at the other. He stopped at the door and heard Kitty give detailed instructions to the maid, and with her help, herself, move the bed. He dressed and while the horse was being harnessed, for it was early and no izvozchiks were about yet, he ran back to the bedroom, not on tiptoe, but, as it seemed to him, on wings. Two maids were busy moving something in the bedroom. Kitty was walking up and down and knitting, rapidly throwing the thread over the needle and giving orders.
"I am going straight to the doctor's. They have already gone for Marya Vlasyevna, but I will call there, too. Is anything else wanted? Oh, yes, to Dolly."
She looked at him, evidently not listening to what he was saying.
"Yes, yes, go,"
she said rapidly, frowning and motioning him away with her hand. He was already on his way through the drawing-room when suddenly a piteous moan that lasted only a moment reached him from the bedroom. He stopped, and for a moment could not understand it.
"Yes, it was she," he said,
and clasping his head with his hands, he ran downstairs.
"Lord have mercy, pardon and help us,"
he repeated the words that suddenly and unexpectedly sprang to his lips. And he, an unbeliever, repeated those words not with his lips only. At that instant he knew that neither his doubts nor the impossibility of believing with his reason, of which he was conscious, at all prevented his appealing to God. It all flew off like dust. To whom should he appeal, if not to him in whose hands he felt himself, his soul, and his love to be? The horse was not yet ready, but feeling particularly energetic, physically strong, and alert to meet what lay before him, so as not to lose a moment, he did not wait for it, but started off on foot, telling Kuzma to catch him up. At the corner he encountered a night izvozchik hurrying along. In the little sledge sat Marya Vlasyevna in a velvet cloak with a shawl over her head. "Thank God," he muttered, recognizing with delight her little blonde face, which now wore a particularly serious and even severe expression. Without stopping the izvozchik, he ran back beside her.
"So it began about 2 hours ago, not more?" she asked. "You will find the doctor, but don't hurry him. And get some opium at the chemist's."
"So you think it may go all right? God have mercy and help us," said Levin as he saw his horse coming out of the gateway.
Jumping into the sledge beside Kuzma, he ordered him to drive to the doctor's. Chapter 14. The doctor was not yet up, and his footman said he had gone to bed late and given orders that he was not to be called, but the footman added that he would be up soon. The man was cleaning lamp glasses and seemed quite absorbed in his task. This attention to his glasses and indifference to what was taking place at the Levin's astonished Levin at first, but he immediately recollected himself and realized that no one knew or was bound to know his feelings, and that it was therefore all the more necessary to act calmly, deliberately, and firmly in order to break through this wall of indifference and to attain his aim.
"Do not hurry, and do not omit anything," he said to himself,
conscious of an increasing uplift of his physical powers and of his attention to all that lay before him. Having learnt that the doctor was not up yet, Levin, out of the many plans that occurred to him, decided on the following. Kuzma should go with a note to another doctor, while he himself would go to the chemist for the opium. And if the doctor was not up when he returned, he would bribe the footman, or, if that was impossible, he would enter by force and wake the doctor at all costs. At the chemist's, a skinny dispenser, with the same indifference with which the footman had cleaned his lamp glasses, closed with a wafer a packet of powders for which a coachman was waiting, and refused to let Levin have any opium. Trying not to hurry and not to get excited, Levin gave the names of the doctor and of the midwife, explained why the opium was wanted, and tried to persuade the dispenser to let him have it. The dispenser asked in German whether he might sell it, and receiving permission from someone behind a screen, took out a bottle and a funnel, slowly poured it from a large bottle into a small one, stuck on a label, and, in spite of Levin's request that he should not do so, sealed up the bottle and was about to wrap it up. This was more than Levin could stand,
He resolutely snatched the bottle out of the man's hands and rushed out at the big glass door. The doctor was not up yet, and the footman, now busy putting down a carpet, refused to wake him. Lievin deliberately took out a 10-ruble note, and speaking slowly but without losing